So we're back on the tape, and now this is part of the regular Sunday morning meeting. So the 300 people that are that were here have now been joined by another 200, and my theme for today is finishing step 12. It's the need, and I spoke earlier before the meeting began on the tape about how, as part of my recovery, I not only have to continue to clean my house, which is step 10. I not only have to continue to make sure that every day I do better than the next day, than the day previous, on living my life according to my higher power's principles, the will of my higher power, but I also must carry the message if I am to keep what I have. And I have to do it with all the energy that I have, because as the big book says on page 102, my job now is to be of maximum helpfulness to others. The only way that I am going to end up keeping at my healthy weight, the only way I'm going to end up being free from the bondage of food, as has happened to me on a daily basis, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless illness of the mind and body. The only way I keep that is by giving it away. And if I do not give it away, I cannot keep it. And so what I want to talk about in the remaining minutes available is the whole concept of what that means. How do I carry the message? Now, the big book was written for people who did not have AA around them. As I said right at the beginning, it was written for people as a do-it-yourself manual for people who did not live in the three centers of AA at the time it was printed in 1939, in Akron, Ohio, in New York, and in Cleveland, Ohio. And anywhere else, there was no AA around. So the big book is a do-it-yourself manual for how to do the steps, and it includes a whole chapter, and a series of chapters actually, on how to carry the message both to others who still suffer and how to practice the principles in all our affairs. I'm going to talk more about carrying the message to those who still suffer rather than practicing the principle in all our affairs, which is in some way the discussion that occurs in the big book in the chapters to the wives, the chapter the family afterwards, the chapter to the employer, and the chapter of A Vision for You. I'll quote a bit from A Vision for You, but not as much. I've already told a lot of the history before the meeting began, a lot of the history of AA that got AA to the point where it put into 1939, where it put into this book, the directions. But the directions are really very, very simple. The first couple of pages of the chapter Working with Others tell you how to find a person. And we're lucky, those of us who live in Winnipeg and those of us who live in any place where OA is organized, because they come to us. We don't have to find them. They come to us as long as there's recovery in our rooms or the hope of recovery in our rooms. They come to us as long as we're able to carry the message. They come to us as long as they've heard of Overeaters Anonymous. Which is not, and they come to us as long as we have a phone number or a website or that someone knows how to get to a meeting. And, you know, this meeting a long time ago decided that instead of saying OA with an arrow in all the directional signs that we have, because we're at, people on the tape don't know this, but we're at the end of a long hallway in a hospital, it's hard to find us. We have a lot of signs up to give people guidance. This meeting decided a long time ago to stop saying OA and to put down Overeaters Anonymous. Because there are people in the hospital who might be interested, maybe people passing by who might say, oh, I wonder what that is. And we actually put down a 12-step group to overcome compulsive eating. No dues, no fees, no scales, it works. Because this group says, as we should all be saying, we're members of a group that have a message to carry to people who still suffer. And there are millions of people who still suffer from the problem that we have. And we have to act as a beacon of hope to them. So, but there are places where OA doesn't exist, and I suppose if I ever moved to one of those places, I would do what the big book suggests, how to find someone who still suffers. They suggest ask around, go to people of faith, go to doctors, and tell them what. The big book tells them, how do you tell someone what you're looking for? Well, on page 90, by the way, this was written by salespeople. If any of you have ever been in sales and been given sales spiels to make, you know, if he says this, you say this, or if she says this, when do you bring the pen out, when do you do this? This was written by people who had written things like this or had experienced them. So there's all this how to sell. This is all written from a sales perspective. Anyway, right at the top of page 90, when you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he doesn't want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You may spoil a later opportunity. This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they're dealing with a sick person. If there's an indication he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested, get an idea of him. In other words, you're sizing him up. But at a certain point, your attention is to be drawn to, his attention is to be drawn to you. And they say on page 90, almost in the middle, a little bit below, watch for the end of a spree, at least for a lucid interval, then let his family or a friend ask him if he wants to quit for good and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. It's again one of the themes that I talked about all the way through that exists in the big book, a person who has recovered, not who is recovering, but who has recovered. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others, and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. And when I go on an airplane and I'm sitting beside someone who is in the least talkative, and certainly if the person is heavy, I don't even wait to see whether that person is in the least talkative, and I strike up a conversation with someone, and the conversation might get on to Overeaters Anonymous, because often I travel in a plane on OA work, and people say, where are you going? And I say, I'm going to an Overeaters Anonymous workshop or something like that. What's that? And the sad thing is so many people haven't heard of us. And we start talking, and they might themselves say, I think I have a problem, or they might say, I know someone has a problem. The chances are 99% that they know someone has a problem. And I say, you know, if that person ever shows an interest in dealing with their food issues, mention Overeaters Anonymous. And you might even say to that person, let's say, you know, I have a son like that, or I have a, you know, they often will say, I have some close relative. You can even say you met someone on the plane who was on a way to an OA workshop. And you can say to that person two things. One is that I can have ice cream in my freezer and it can go bad and I don't care, and that for me that's a miracle. And the second is that it will do me good. They'll be doing me a favor if they want me to talk to them. Which is in accordance. I'm a person who has recovered, and it's part of my recovery to talk to others. They're doing me a favor. I'm not doing them a favor. They're doing me a favor. So they talk about how to talk to this person, and they start on page 91. And this is so simple. And as I said before we broke this morning, it's so unlike what they started off with. It's they really refined the sales pitch, if you will, and figured out what really, really worked. And what really works, they describe as a short conversation, no more than 2 hours. And it's basically this. You tell your story. You never say that they are alcoholics or compulsive eaters. You tell your own story. You tell your eating story. And you tell it in a way that describes the twofold problem of the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. So you tell it in a way that they begin to understand that you were doomed, and you describe how doomed you were, because once you started, you couldn't stop, and you also couldn't stop from starting. And so you tell your eating stories. As I began this big book study on Friday with telling my eating stories, and I told them on two different levels. The first level was the level of eating and eating uncontrollably with my mind unable to stop myself from continuing to eat. If you're like me, you've got those stories. They're stories of uncontrollable eating, and they may not have occurred to you as often as they occurred to me, or my stories may not have occurred to me as often as they've occurred to other people, maybe eating constantly. But whatever they are, the symbol of them is the hand with the food moving to the mouth constantly, and the mind saying, I've got to stop. I must stop. This is terrible. I'll stop the next bite. I'll stop the next bite, and never stopping. But you have your, I have my goose skin story. I have my, you know, vomiting story. I have all kinds of stories that I can tell. But you, each one of you has his or her own story and series of stories about uncontrollable eating. And this describes the first aspect of the problem, which is that our bodies are different from normal people. Normal people get full. Normal people get a sense of unease and discomfort, even if they eat something that they love. And we don't know what that means with certain kinds of foods or with certain kinds of eating behaviors. Doesn't mean it always happens. I have been full in my life, I guess. Yeah, I guess I have, once or twice in my life. I don't know if it ever came from eating cheesecake or ice cream, but I've been stuffed, but never full. There's always been that emptiness there that I wanted to fill. So I can tell those stories. And you can contrast that with other kinds of addictions that other people may have, where you may have tried it and not had that feeling that they have and not wanted to go further. I can talk to that about wine and beer. I don't drink hard liquor, but I can't drink more than a glass and a half of beer or a glass and a half of wine, however good the taste, and occasionally it can be really good, before I start to get kind of uneasy and uncomfortable. I just don't want any more, as good as the taste might be. And I can talk about my wife, who has that with food. She loves chocolate. She loves deep, dark chocolate. But she can't eat too much of it before her body says, you've had too much. And that whole sense helps describe me as a person whose body clearly is different. And I can go into all kinds of details or all kinds of medical ideas as to why that might be the case. But there's no question that it's true about me. And unfortunately, I don't think it's become a generally accepted concept among dietitians and nutritionists and doctors and diet experts. But it's pretty obvious to me that I can't eat certain foods without feeling a complete lack of control and wanting more of them. And then I begin to say, but that's not my real problem. That's like an allergy. I get an allergic reaction. I just can't stop eating. It's abnormal. That's what allergy means, an abnormal physical reaction to a physical substance. So once I identify the foods that cause this problem, because it doesn't occur with radishes, and it doesn't occur with tofu, and it doesn't occur with beans, you know. Once I identify these foods, or identify certain eating behaviors that cause it to me, like the need to crunch and chew. If I don't crunch and chew or suck all the time, then I don't have this need to eat all the time. Or if I don't eat right up to the top of my neck, I don't have this need to be even fuller. You know, I mean, whatever it is. Or if I don't eat after 6 o'clock at night, I don't have this need to eat uncontrollably. Maybe eating behaviors, or maybe certain foods. If I were a sane human being, all I would have to do is just avoid those eating behaviors and those foods that cause me the problems. But I go on and say, but here's the other part of my eating story. And then I begin to go through all the excuses that I've ever had for going back to eating, even while I knew that I shouldn't be. Even after having been away from these foods for a long time and not feeling any cravings. My body doesn't want them anymore. It hasn't had them for a long time, so it's not saying more, more, more. But my mind gives me excuses. And you have your own list, and I have my own list, but I give a list, and usually there's a lot of overlap. I'm standing up, so it doesn't count. It's not part of my meal. It's only got X number of calories, so I can have some. I've exercised for a half an hour, so I can have this whole gallon of ice cream, because clearly I must have worked it off. I'm terribly depressed. I'm so depressed, and nothing else will make me feel good but this food. I'm so happy, and I need to celebrate. What can I celebrate with? What will make me feel even happier? Food. I'm so lonely. I'm so isolated. I need something to make me feel better. Food. too many people love me. I've got so many people around me. I can't take it too much food. My favorite is it's free. They made it especially for you. You'll never be able to have this taste again. And my favorite, because it's the one that caused me to break all my diets, was I've been good for a year. I've been good for 6 months. I've been good for a month. I've been good for a week. I've been good for a day. I've been good for an hour. I didn't eat the bun so I can have the dessert. You know, and everyone understands that. And I talk about other stories about the moment at which I just clicked. And, you know, the big book has a sort of a great concept of parallel with our sound reasoning, our insane reasoning won out. And I can often talk about, you know, those of us who are old enough will remember Mickey Mouse and the good Mickey and the bad Mickey on either shoulder, you know. Don't do it, Mickey, don't do it. And yes, you can, yes, you can. You know, and so the example of, you know, I've got this food in front of me, and the good Mickey part of me is saying, you know, Laurie, if you have this food, you're going to gain weight again. You won't be able to stop eating it. You know what all this food means to you. It means you're going to get diabetes. It means you're going to suffer all the problems that diabetes did to your mother and your grandmother and your grandfather. You're going to get joint problems. You're really going to suffer. So you really shouldn't eat this. Don't do it. And the other side of me is saying, come on. You know, why not? Can't hurt. And these two voices are going on in my mind until, you can't do it, Laurie. You can't do it, Laurie. Come on. Okay. You know, and that little click. Now, that's my story. I'm sure you can tell your own stories, and I'm sure some of you can tell stories that are far more horrendous than my stories. Whatever those stories are, that's what the big book says we start talking about. And the other person either says, I'm like that, or says, I'm not like that. And you know, if they say they're not like that, the big book says, thank them and leave. If they're not like that, then they're not, the 12 steps aren't for them. I mean, they may be for them in some theoretical sense, the 12 steps are good for everyone, but they're not going to be desperate enough because they don't feel the same identification. But the chances are, if they've come to this meeting, the chances are that if they've really wanted to see you, and if their family wants them to see you, that they will begin to identify with you. And if you point out that these two strands, this not being able to stop once I've started, and having all the excuses in the world for starting again, creates a vicious circle that you cannot get out, that I could not get out from under myself. Absolutely impossible. Because I had this mind that kept giving me permission to go back to the foods. And I point out that in this world, in our society at any rate, most doctors and nutritionists and dietitians and diet clubs and diet magazines, or magazines that contain diets, seem to avoid the truth, or don't seem to accept the truth that is for me but isn't necessarily for everyone, that there are certain foods I can never eat without getting these cravings, these uncontrollable cravings. And so that they all give us the prospect of someday being able to eat those foods that I know I can't eat. And as a matter of fact, some of them these days are so modern and progressive that they allow me to eat those foods while I'm trying to lose weight. And I say, some people, that's all you need. You just have to know how to eat moderately. Some diets provide people with information that they do not have, which is how much they really need to keep their bodies alive. And they can just sort of say, oh, that's what 4 ounces of meat means? Okay, that's what I'll eat. I don't need to eat anymore. Oh, deck of cards, okay. I understand that. That's the size. Some people don't need what I need. But what the big book says I tell them is, here's where I am. I'm hopeless on my own. And yet I'm not hopeless at all because I have recovered. And the big book says, let him ask you how you got that way because he will be curious. And of course he will be. Now, in the context of OA, people come and they hear us talk about it, and they know that we study the 12 steps. It won't be quite this, let him ask if he will. You know, I mean, it's not going to be quite the sales pitch that the big book talks about, but it'll happen. And then they say you stress freely the spiritual angle. You tell that person exactly how you have recovered. You tell that person what you did. Because you do not hide from that person that this is work. And that it's different work from what that person might be expecting from having gone to other diet to diet clubs or to reading diets in magazines or watching television or something like that. And because that person isn't going to do anything this serious unless that person knows, A, that he or she is desperate and doomed, hopelessness, that's step one. Admitted we're powerless over food, their lives have become unmanageable. And two, that there is hope. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And if they don't understand where that hope comes from, a power greater than ourselves, and are willing to search for that power, then they're not going to do the steps. And they're going to start using us as a support group. And using us as a support group is maybe fine for them, but it's not what we're here for. So the Big Book talks about that. And it says you do this, and the way it talks about it, I encourage you to read it, you'll find in the book that's available on the website or the book that is reproduced here, and I don't know if it was reproduced separately, what I call a schematic outline of the Big Book. It's sort of like a broken down every chapter sort of broken down into sections, so you can sort of see where the arguments are and where the thing lies. And I've broken it down page by page as to sort of what the Big Book sales pitch is. But basically, the Big Book says this at the end. Oh, by the way, it says, you're talking now about spiritual matters, and your prospect may know more about religion than you do. Listen to the language. This is on page 93. Admit he probably knows more about it than you do, but call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it, or he would not drink. Perhaps your story will help him to see where he has failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. You know, faith without works is dead. You're not practicing what you believe. And the Big Book's approach, and what we talked about earlier, this whole concept that what the Big Book approach, or what the 12 steps offer, not just the Big Book, but what the 12 steps offer, is this notion that what the 12 steps do is remove the barriers between what you believe in and what you do, and what your mind is thinking and acting on. And that there's a block there. And if you could just get rid of that block, what you deeply believe in will become what you live for, rather than separated from what you do and what you believe in. And that God does not have to be anything more or anything less than what you believe in. And it doesn't have to be a being of any kind whatsoever. I mean, as an agnostic, I'm able to say that much more simply than someone who might come from a religious point of view. But someone who comes from a religious point of view has to remember that they may be meeting people like me who don't believe in a God, who don't have any being that they believe in or willing to believe in or care to believe in. And yet this program is open to us as well. And it's open to us as well because all that's required of us is to be willing to believe that we can find some kind of power. And it doesn't have to be a God that is normally talked about within religions. It can be a good orderly direction. It can be a sense of dedication to truth. It can be the group itself as a concept of humanity at its best. It doesn't have to be anything more or less than that. So we talk about that. And on page 94, they say, outline the program of action explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. I thank people for listening to me. They're doing me a favor. I don't know what's going to happen to them, but I know that they're helping me. Now, page 95, right in the middle, if he's not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. If he's sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval. After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. and then you leave them. So we're talking 2 hours. And then on page 96, it says, do not be discouraged, right at the top. If your prospect does not respond at once, search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. I'm going to talk very briefly about how I sponsor, but one of the things I do when I sponsor, and there are people in this room who have both been sponsored by me and have left me as a sponsor because they don't necessarily appreciate the way I sponsor, but I follow this very carefully. I don't spend a lot of time with people I sponsor because it's up to them to recover, not up to me. I give them whatever information I can about how to recover. I tell them I'm there for them 24 hours a day if they're about to eat some food because they have to get abstinent in order to work the steps. Take that for granted. And while they're working the steps, I'm there as much as they want in order to help them keep from eating. I tell them that if at 4 in the morning they're about to eat a donut, they can phone me. And I will not just speak to them on the phone. If necessary, I'll go meet with them. Because I take it that seriously as any alcoholic would take it seriously if someone phoned and said, I'm about to drink a beer. I also say, if you've already eaten a donut, phone me in the morning. I don't need to talk to you while you're drunk. I'll talk to you afterwards, and we'll talk about what mistakes you made, about how you could prevent it, and we'll help you work that through. I meet with them, and if they're interested, they're the ones who make the appointments. They're the ones who keep track of where we are. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to mollycoddle them. It's up to them to work their program. And if they need to be mollycoddled, from my point of view, the big book says, let them suffer some more until they realize that it's serious business. It's not up to me. So that's what I do. They say, suppose now you're making your second visit to man. He's read this volume, says he's prepared to go through the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision, step three, because step three, the big book says you should say the step three prayer in the presence of another person, a spiritual advisor. If he wishes to make a decision, and tell his story, which is step five, if you're available, if he wants to do a step five with you. But don't insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. So you're now giving this person advice on how to work the steps. What's your advice? This is how I was taught. I give people advice on what I was taught. I tell them, this is what I know. I also tell them this. I say, I'm not your spiritual advisor. I'm not your counselor. I'm not your therapist. I don't know any answers. I only know what I've been taught about how to work the steps. And I will do anything to help you understand what I've been taught. Because it helps me to help you if you want to work the steps. But I'm not here, because I don't have any answers, to speak to you just to make you feel good. I'm here to help you work the steps, because that would really make you feel good. Now, that's very different from the way a lot of other people sponsor, and I appreciate that, and how they sponsor works for them, and it works for a lot of people. So I don't call down what other people do in the least. I know there are a lot of other ways of working these steps, and not just the Big Book way. I'm just giving you what I've learned from the Big Book. Now, they talk about, do we give to this person? Do we find this person a place to stay? Do we do anything for this person? Do we give this person any money? Alcoholics often have many more problems than I guess a lot of compulsive eaters who come to our program do. And their answer is, yeah, but not really. Clancy, this wonderful AA speaker, tells a wonderful story about he's thrown out of the last flop house in Los Angeles. This is a guy who used to be a university professor. And he's drunk out of his mind. He's lost his front teeth. He has no place to stay, so he goes to an AA club room to get some donuts and coffee. And a guy comes up to him and says, I'm Bob. I'm your sponsor. Oh. Hi, Bob. Read the book. The big book, obviously. Oh. Thank you, Bob. I don't have any place to read it in. I don't have any place to read the book. But I have no food. I have no job. I have no place to live. Read the book. You know, sort of like that kind of tough way of talking. And the big book has that. And listen to this. Page 98, right at the top. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. And I go a bit further, until not just his material needs are cared for, but even his emotional needs are cared for. Because a lot of us in our program, and I did this for many years, we listen to people talk about their anguish and the pain that they're going through. They're there, love, compassion and all that. And we're sort of meeting their emotional needs. And it's the same as meeting their financial needs. Listen to what the Big Book says about this. He clamors, he cannot master alcohol until his material and, I'll say, emotional needs are cared for. Nonsense! The shortest sentence in the Big Book. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. And from my point of view, and I only give you my point of view and my understanding of this, that means that when people phone me with a problem, my answer is, well, what step are you on? What step will help you with this problem? I don't have answers to people, nor do I want to comfort them emotionally, other than to say the answers to your problem will come through working the steps. And I'll help you as much as I can work the steps. I have a young friend, a very close person in our family, who has another addiction, who has for a number of years now known about the 12-step program, has even gone to a 12-step program to deal with it, but keeps wanting to talk about problems rather than solution, and hasn't worked the steps. And another friend of his has recently started to go to the anonymous program like Al-Anon to deal with that, and has recently, instead of listening to the problems and spending hours and hours going to coffee shops with that person, has learned to say, well, that's really difficult. What step are you on? What are you going to do about it? Have you spoken to your sponsor? Are you working the steps? Because as I understand it, that's the only way you're going to recover. So it's a kind of a tough love. And as I think I told you, Dr. Bob, who was a saint in this program, told Sister Ignatia, who used to run this St. Thomas Hospital, at certain times, get this guy out of the ward. He's not interested in working the steps. The whole idea, if someone becomes dependent upon me, they won't learn to become dependent upon God. So I don't want to be their God. I don't want to be the sponsor who gives them their answers. I don't want to be the person they turn to for their answers. I want them to turn only to a higher power and to understand that only through the higher power will they get any long-lasting relief. So I think the Big Book is really tough on this. Page 100 are a few promises. Right at the top, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I mean, isn't that a sentence? No matter whether you're living in a lousy world, it'll be a wonderful world. I have a good friend in this program. He's passed on. He's not in OA, but he was in AA. And this is before, he had made a lot of money in a particular business, was living really high. And he made a business decision to franchise his company, and it went belly up. And he ended up going bankrupt. And I saw him about a year after he went bankrupt. And he was a happy man. He had a copy of the AA 12 and 12 in his pocket. He said, this is my guide to life. It has a lot of wonderful things about financial insecurity in it. So it's really a good book in that respect. I said, well, what are you doing now? He said, I work at the Health Sciences Center. I'm an orderly. And then he said, and pardon my language, but I'm just quoting him, he says, "I clean shit off men and give them dignity." I thought, you know, there's a way of looking at your new and wonderful world. He's giving people dignity. He does something that a lot of people would consider to be really awful, disgusting work. But he, because he was a recovered human being, was living in a new and wonderful world where he gave dignity to someone. So a great story about, there's a church that's being built in New York. It's taken 100 years. It's being built by hand. It's one of those. It's a copy, sort of those old great European churches. And someone goes to that church and he sees someone working on a sculpture. "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing a sculpture of Saint so and so." And he sees someone else who's working on stained glass. "What are you doing?" "I'm making this beautiful picture in stained glass." And he sees someone sweeping up some debris. He says, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I'm building a cathedral." You know, that's this new and wonderful world, no matter what our present circumstances. At the bottom, some more promises. Assuming we're spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served, we must not have it in our homes, we must shun friends who drink, we must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes, we must not go into bars, our friends must hide their bottles if we go into their houses, we mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all, we mustn't go to meetings where food is discussed. I say that. Because although it's not true for Winnipeg, it used to be true for Winnipeg. Years ago, we had meetings where you could not discuss food. You couldn't mention foods. And it's true somewhere in OA. I know. I once spoke at a convention in Florida, and I told my stories of my eating my goose, and my eating ice cream and things like that. And someone came up to me afterwards and says, "You don't know what danger you put some of the people in the room in. They're going to go out and eat. You made it sound so good that they're going to go out and eat." And my reaction was, what does a big book say about this? We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There's something the matter with his spiritual status. His only choice for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland Ice Cap, and even there an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. They go on, "In our rule, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger exposure than ever. We've tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed." And, a friend of mine, who actually came to speak here a couple of years ago, Bob, talked about going to a meeting where someone couldn't, from Toronto, someone couldn't, well, a meeting where you couldn't mention food. And someone spoke about it, and she said, "And then I began to eat these round balls that had kind of like a creamy texture." And Bob talked about how he talked to two other people who were at that meeting right after the meeting, and they were all, "What was she talking about?" And they all had a different idea of what it was that she was talking about. And they went to her and asked her what it was, and she had a fourth, and it was something completely different with all three of them. I mean, you end up, and imagine an AA meeting where someone says, "And then I picked up a glass of a brown fizzy liquid." You know, I mean, how can I tell my stories of eating if I can't talk about goose? So, anyway, I just point out. Anyway, so the big book goes on and says, "So our rule is not to avoid a place where there's drinking or eating if there's a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, or even plain ordinary whoopee parties." You know, these are parties where people put cushions on the seats and they go, "To a person who's had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. You'll note that we made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place?" I have found that to be the greatest guide in the world for me. Because sometimes I say, "I don't want to go to this party. I don't want to engage in these." And then I say to myself, "Why am I going? Oh, I'm going because my friend invited me, and I'm paying some respect to my friend because my friend would like me to come. Or I'm going because my purpose in going here has a business purpose." You know, I mean, I'm going to a convention in 4 days, a business convention where I don't think I'll know anyone, and I'm not looking forward to it. But if I think to myself, why am I going to this place? I know why I'm going. I'm going to meet people, to learn something about the business that this is about. And if I accomplish that, I'll be fine. And I won't feel lonely because I have a purpose in going. So it's really good. Anyway, they talk on page 102 about telling your friends about it. And you should. You should not be embarrassed to talk about what you're doing. You're solving your problem. You're taking steps to do that. This is a wonderful thing. People now almost take it as a badge of honor that they're members of AA. Why shouldn't we be proud that we're members of OA? Not proud in a prideful, pompous sense, but at least that we can say, I'm trying to do something with my life. I'm trying to make something out of what I'm doing. And on page 102, your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand, even a buffet. You know, I mean, alcoholics have it tougher. They go to pretty crummy places. We have, our food laws seem to be a little bit better than our liquor laws. You know, like the liquor establishments seem to be a lot seedier than a lot of, than even the worst kind of food places. I could be wrong, though. Maybe I've never been to kitchens, so who knows. I just want to finish just a few things, and then I'll be done. I talked about sponsorship. I also say that I believe as a sponsor that I have a duty to work towards a healthy body weight, and I've done that, and I talked about how I did that. That I cannot carry the message if I do not live the message. Obviously, I mean, I've sponsored people who've weighed 400 pounds or 300 pounds, and after 3 months, they've worked the steps, they're freed from food, they're recovered, but they haven't lost a lot of weight. It's only been 3 months. And they're very careful to say, I'm available to sponsor, and I'm losing weight, but it's taking time. But I am free of the bondage of food, and I can tell the same stories that anyone else can tell. That I can be around this food and not want it. So I think there is that responsibility. I wanted to talk about, just point out, I think I already quoted, but point out that the horrible things that have happened to us now become the coins with which we pay our debt to the world, and it's now our the richness that we have. The horrible things that have happened to us, that either happened to us or that we have done, some of us have done horrible things, are now the things that we can now say to others, I have experienced this and I'm now a different person. I'm now, God willing, going to continue to be a different person. And I don't eat over what I've done. I don't feel guilt or fear or pain. I can remember what has happened and it has now become a storehouse of help to other people. It's a wonderful thing. I talked about provocations at the beginning of doing this, and I'm going to go back to them and see if I've covered them. The first provocation is, I am a recovered compulsive eater, not a recovering one. I think I've beaten that to death, so I'm not going to go too much into that. Right? I've beaten it to death, to those of you who've been here, yes. Two, abstinence is not the most important thing in my life without exception. The consciousness of the presence of God is. I quote it to you from the big book in We Agnostic, which says, when many hundreds of people say that the most important thing in their life is the consciousness of the presence of God, that speaks a lot. Why is it the most important thing in my life? Because as long as I keep the consciousness of the presence of God, I'm sane. And as long as I'm sane, the foods that are my killer foods and the eating behaviors that are my killer eating behaviors are abhorrent to me. They're like poison. For me, abstinence is not something I work at. It comes to me because I work at my relationship with my higher power. I don't work at abstinence at all. It's second nature to me. Three, although a sponsor, if available, is very important for recovery, a sponsor is not necessary to recover. I only point that out to say that if you can't find someone who's just perfect for you, and some of us are perfectionists, and we use this as an excuse not to work the steps, the Big Book provides a way of doing the steps without a sponsor. Better you have a sponsor. Better you have someone to guide you. But if you don't, you still can't get away from the fact that it's your responsibility to work the steps, not anyone else's. Four, you can recover in weeks. I think I have shown how easy it is to do a step four, at least the Big Book way, and there are other ways of doing them relatively quickly. Not easy, but quickly. And that you do 5, 6, 7, 8 in the same day, and that 9 you can do, and you recovered after 9. So what stops you from working the steps quickly? And I think I've also pointed out that from the Big Book perspective, from the history of AA, that only steps 1 and 4 and 5 and 9 And 11 and 12 were part of the original program, and that the Big Book spends a proportionate amount of time on those, and that 6 and 7 are quick, at least the Big Book way. 5, the tools of recovery are not an essential part of the OA program. My concern about the tools is not that they're not valuable. They are. The tools are there to help you keep abstinent while you're working the program. Once you finish step 9, you don't need to do anything other than work the program. The steps will give you that recovery. The danger with the tools is if people use them as a substitute for the steps, because they're not a substitute for the steps. The tools don't give you recovery. They may help you keep abstinent, but they do not give you recovery. The steps give you recovery. That's what this program stands for. You don't take steps 1 and 2. I think I've talked about that. Steps 3, 6, 7, 8 should not take a long time to get to. I talked about that. You don't make amends to yourself. I did talk about that. I was asked again about that. I can only say that the Big Book is all about helping others and making up for the harm you've done to others. You do make an amend to yourself in the most important way, A, by never becoming an enabler, because you realize that enabling people does harm to others. So you learn to say no. You learn to take care of yourself. You learn not to be a person who does things for everyone else because that harms them. And the second is you become a different person, a person who won't do the things that you have been doing. So there's an amend to yourself that's bigger than anything else. You're a different person from what you used to be. You should not sponsor until after you've completed step 9. What I mean by that, and we'll see this in the closing passage that I read, that you cannot give away what you don't have. You can help other people if you haven't recovered. And I will often say to a sponsee, you know, while you're trying to, while you're working the steps and you're abstinent and you're in this race with, well, you get to step 9 and recover before your mind persuades you to go back to the food, why don't you, instead of phoning me every day, why don't you get a food buddy, someone else in the program who still hasn't, who is also working the steps, and phone each other every day. Phone your food into that person and help each other, because then you'll help each other a lot more than helping me. Service is not slimming. I'm living proof of that. There are people in this room who know how active I have been in this program while I was in relapse, and it never got me out of relapse. Just kept me busy. On the other hand, service can keep you busy if you're trying to keep from eating while you're working the steps. But the purpose of service is to further the existence of Overeaters Anonymous, which is important so long as Overeaters Anonymous is a good carrier of the message of the 12 steps. Food can be discussed at meetings. I've talked about that. And some people who come to OA should consider not coming back unless and until they're ready. That's part of the tough love that the Big Book talks about. One last comment about the traditions. I used to be a member of that very secret, covert organization known as the Traditions Police. We would call up violations of traditions at any moment's notice if we thought that someone was violating a tradition. I've resigned from the force. I've decided that the number one tradition that we all must focus on is that the primary purpose of an OA meeting is to carry the message the compulsive eater still suffers. And that means that what works should stay and what doesn't work should be examined. And if something is going on, and the traditions are not rules, they're not laws, they are simply traditions. There's a passage in AA Comes of Age, in the initial creation of AA in Japan, where someone writes to the business office in New York and says, there's a catastrophe in Japan. There are two AAs. One has 10 steps and charges 7 yen for meetings, and the other has the 12 steps and doesn't charge anything. What do we do? And the message comes back, well, maybe the 10 step people are right. Time will tell. God will tell. You know, we don't take ourselves too seriously. Those of you who have read the AA 12 and 12 will have heard of tradition number 63, which was, or rule number 63. A group had set up 62 rules and blew itself up completely. And the guy who enforced all those rules passed around a little card, a two-piece card. It said rule 63 on it. You open it up, it says, don't take yourself too damn seriously. So I'm going to finish this Big Book study. I'll tell you a story, and I'll read to you from the last page of A Vision for You. The story is designed to, well, I'll tell you the story. An AA speaker comes to an AA meeting, and he wows everyone, gets a standing ovation, speaks for an hour. People are just wild. And they come up to him afterwards. One says, oh, God, your interpretation of step three just blew my mind. It changed my life. Don't thank me, thank God. And another person comes up and says, you know, your dedication to this program has really proved to me what's lacking in my program. I'm going to become a better person. Thank you. Don't thank me, thank God. And an old-timer comes, a long-timer comes up to him and says, that was a really good talk. Don't thank me, thank God. The long-timer looks at him and says, it wasn't that good. And a lot of people thank me, and I'm really thankful that people get something out of what I do. But I never, ever, ever want to be a star in this program. I was a star about a year into this program because, hey, you know, I was taught how to be a teacher. I'm a lawyer. I've studied English. I know how to read text, and I know how to teach. And it's not hard for me to get up in front of a group of people and do what I did. As a matter of fact, it gives me energy, and I love doing it. So I'm thanking you, and I don't want ever to be a star. You know, my sponsees will phone me with a problem. And you know what my answer to them is? Do a step 10 on them. I don't know what the answer is. I do know you'll get the answer from step 10. And so I don't have answers, but I do have a lot of things I've been taught, and I really appreciate having this opportunity. So, I mean, that's really all I need, and I'm not that good. I want to finish off by reading the last couple paragraphs of the big book, of page 164. I'm going to use the word trudge, or it uses the word trudge. Don't let anyone tell you that the word trudge means walk with a purposeful step. You won't find that in any dictionary, either old or new. Trudge means what it sounds like, walk with a weary step. But it's a weary step because we work hard, but in working hard, we live beyond our wildest dreams, as Roseanne's statement says. We find something that is more wonderful than anything we could have imagined. So let me read it. Page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. That is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then. So thank you very, very much.